Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Home in on end-of-season savings on bedding, curtains, wallpapers and more. In-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Colm O'Mungine here till 3 o'clock. You can get us on 1850 715 815. If you're calling from the north, 08457 853333, 087 484 8888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 for your texts, and joe@rte.ie for your emails. Billy Hennessy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm.
When you cast an eye over the news that the HSE was going to reduce reimbursements for cataract operations in the north, what was your reaction to it?
Well, I was trying to get in before they were to do that, like me. So I got on to Michael Collins.
And that's
he arranged a bus with me.
Your local TD there, who's involved in organising buses to Northern Ireland.
Organising buses every week, yes, that's right, yes.
And can you tell us, for anyone who's not familiar with this, what's your own situation with cataracts and how does this bus to the north work?
Well, I went up on Monday, the bank holiday of August bank holiday. And there was 11 of us on that bus going up. And we were done on the Tuesday. Now, we left Cork, like you mean, at 8 o'clock. And we arrived in Kingsbridge Private Hospital in Derry at 10 past 4. And the one consultant then, like me, had to see us. And we were brought in then. There was three of us brought in, myself and three others brought in the following morning at 6:30. And I was first down at 8 o'clock. And by 9 o'clock, like you mean, I was done.
And you have cataracts. And you have cataracts. Is it in both eyes, Billy?
In one eye. I had a cataract in one eye, and I need laser in the left eye.
Okay.
So they did the cataract treatment in the right eye.
And had you looked into getting the operation done here in the south?
Yes. My eyes were checked last November, and I was told that I had a cataract in the right eye, and I needed Yak laser in the left, and that they would send a referral letter, and I had private health insurance at the time, and that I'd be waiting a few months. And after a few months, when I checked to find out, that there was no referral letter sent. So when I got back to the people that checked my eyes, they checked them again, and they said that they would send another referral letter. So this is kind of 7 months later, and I was told by the clinic that I would get an appointment at this side of 12 months, which means that I have now given up private health insurance. It's up at the end of this month, so I haven't taken the new policy.
And how did you hear about the bus to the north that leaves from Cork?
I've heard a lot about it, especially when I had the cataract, and it was people telling me, that Michael Collins was running it from Cork, and that Michael Healy Ray was running the bus from Kerry. So I got in contact. I got in contact with Michael Collins, and he arranged the rest.
And how long did it take between you hearing about it, making contact about getting on the bus, and you being on the bus on the road up to Derry?
I think about 2 weeks. 2 to 3 weeks, because Michael Collins, I tell you, he's an amazing man. And what he's doing for the people, of Cork City and County, it's unreal. And I think, when the election comes around, we need that man back in the Dáil again, what he is doing for the people is unreal.
All right. There are other political representatives down there, and he's done great work for you, and credit to him for that. But in your own situation, then, so it's 2 weeks. You got to Derry. Tell us about putting, I suppose, the money together for this. How much is the overall cost? Because you've got the bus up, you've got accommodation, you have to pay for the procedure and the bus back down again. All told, how much is it, and how did you manage that?
Well, the bus and the hotel is a separate thing, because you don't get reimbursed for that, But the bus is €120. the hotel then would be £130. But the procedure, like, I mean, is £2,095 and £130 for the consultant. Now, I mean, if we put that into euros, that's 2,513.65 for the procedure and 157.40 for the consultant, which I had to pay 2,671.05. And I paid that by credit card, and then I get a loan from the credit union to pay off the credit card.
Okay. And heretofore, in the, when the funding was first available for reimbursement, that funding would have been €2,000, and that's now been cut to €1,150. So you still would have been paying around 600, close to €700 yourself out of pocket.
Yes.
But now that's gone up by another 800, so you're looking at about €1,500 out of pocket under the new reimbursement system.
Under the new scheme, yes.
And would you have been as attracted to going north if you knew that you were going to be out of pocket by €1,500, or do you think you would have taken your chances on waiting and using your private health insurance?
Well, I mean, if they're talking about 12 months of a waiting time for private health insurance, and now, like me, seeing that I don't have private health insurance, I believe that the waiting time for public is between 4 and 5 years.
So basically what you're saying is you'd have had to pay the €1,500, but the financial pain would have been all the greater on top of what you're already suffering with your eyes.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
And what would the impact be? Were you told about waiting that length of time, 4 to 5 years in the public system or 12 months, even with private health insurance? What would the impact have been on your cataracts and also on the other eye that needed laser?
Well, I get blind, like you could say. I mean, that's because, I mean, even at the moment, I mean, with the cataracts that's been done and I need laser on the left, like me, I'm still going around like the cross-eyed line, you know, and things are difficult, like, I mean, but I mean, with the two eyes, like, I mean, being bad, like, I mean, there was no way, like, I mean, that I would leave it go on that long, like, I mean, you know, I just couldn't.
Teresa Holland, you've been north as well. You went to Belfast. What did you need done on your eye?
A cataract on my right eye. And I kind of second everything that the last caller was saying. It is amazing. And I was going, it's an amazing service, but I was waiting 3.5 years. I had no health insurance, so I was waiting that long.
So you were on a list. You had already waited 3.5 years before you made contact about the bus.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a long time.
So you took an early bus. But by the way, when people are getting on the bus, you've people like yourself who've been waiting a long time. I mean, what's the atmosphere like on the bus when people are going up to get this operation done after waiting so long or hearing that the waiting list would be long?
Well, it's all kind of a bit quietish, but then people start to be chatting just generally. And I think everybody's heard a good bit about what kind of happens. And then when everything's done, everybody gets, and they've had their treatment done, everybody's with their thumbs up and they're delighted that, you know, it's all been done and it was so slick. Everything was, you know, organised so well. But it's just a long, long time you're waiting and your eyesight is just getting worse and worse.
And what was the effect on you? Can you give people an insight into that?
Well,
over that 3.5 years, what point did you begin at and where had it declined to by the time you made contact about getting the bus?
I wore glasses. So when you go to Specsavers and they say, you know, they kept strengthening my glasses, and then a few years ago, they said, you have a start of cataract. And then they said, get your doctor to refer you to eye clinic. And I was waiting a year on that. And then I phoned a hospital and they said they're just overwhelmed at the amount of people. And there'd be and this was after a year, and I was told it would be 4 years. It's such a big list. So then I was just carrying on. But my eyesight was getting very, not very blurry, but different, hazier. And the last time I had my glass, my eyes tested at Specsavers, they said, you have, it's progressed. You have cataract. And then they said, if it goes on much more, you won't be able to drive. Well, that was it then. And I knew about Michael and Collins's and the brilliant work that they are doing down here in West Cork. And so I got hold of him and asked, I asked what happened. And then I asked if he could get me on up to Belfast. And it took a couple of weeks. And he got back to me and said that he got, I had a place. And then the ball was rolling. And I'm just absolutely delighted.
And as you say, you were told you wouldn't be able to drive if your eyesight had declined further. You're living in a rural area, so obviously that would have had a serious effect on your life.
Absolutely devastated. But I just can't get over the clarity when you take the patch off after you're all like pirates on the bus coming back, and then you take that off the next day. And the vision is absolutely vibrant.
So describe that to me. You've gone up with blurry vision, you've had a procedure done, you're travelling with a patch, then you have no vision. So when you're given clear to take that patch off your eye and begin your treatment, the post-operative treatment with eye drops and all of that kind of thing, which nobody particularly likes. But in terms of the improvement in your vision, what's the payoff like? What's the moment like where you'd peel off that patch?
It's just amazing. I just can't express the clarity, and the vibrancy of everything. The colours, I think it's amazing.
And can you remember what the first thing you saw was when you peeled the patch off?
Trees. Because I was at my daughter's and peeled off the patch. And I was you're half nervous to kind of open your eye fully. But you just can't get over it.
Is it like that bit in The Wizard of Oz where the film changes from black and white to Technicolor?
Absolutely.
All right.
Brilliant.
And then suppose the financial reimbursement of €2,000 that was on offer from the HSE before this 40% reduction, what difference did that make to you in getting this procedure done?
Well, I felt lucky, very lucky. And it would have been a lot harder because you kind of would put yourself in debt because you can't have your eyesight going so bad for the want of having this procedure done. You don't want to put yourself in debt. So I was delighted to be able to get this done before you don't get so much back. But I just feel it's just a crying shame that the government are doing this when you get people like Michael Collins and his people trying to do the best for people.
And had you heard, in all the time you're waiting, in the 3.5 years, did anyone say to you, you can go north and avail of a €2,000 reimbursement, or did you only find that out through local networks or through your optician?
Well, no, I knew about it from being local, not quite at first, the 4 years ago, but it was later on and people said you can go up north. And then I was thinking, well, I don't know, would I be able to afford that? And then when you've been told your eyesight's getting worse, you just have to, try your best, either which way you can, to get it done.
And but nobody from the public system, when you were being notified of how long your wait was going to be or anything, nobody wrote to you and said, look, if you don't want to wait this long, there is another option.
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. It was all done from down here, in my case, with Michael.
Tom O'Neill, what was the first thing that you looked at when you took the patch off after the operation?
Oh, I just couldn't believe it. How clear everything was. I would definitely agree with that speaker's just been talking about.
Treasy, yeah.
I thought it was absolutely amazing. Because I was taught that as well, like 4 years of a waiting list. And At the time, I couldn't drive the car and couldn't do it. I had to ask somebody to help me all the time.
And was it cataracts with you, Tom?
Yeah, cataracts in both eyes. Oh, it was terrible. A friend of ours just said, "Did you hear about the blind bus?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And I got on to Danny Healy, and his secretary, she was fantastic. She just took it from there, really. I just followed on, went to Belfast and had one eye done. And then I think it was a couple of weeks later, I had the other eye done. It was amazing.
And how much do you pay in one go, or and go back for the second bit, or do you pay per procedure? And if so, how much is it, if you can remember, Tom, per eye?
Well, as far as it was like that first caller was talking about, I think it was $2,500. I can't really remember how much at the time, because
Billy Hennessy was saying
all the finances.
Billy was saying it's about $2,600 for the eye he got done. And was it that fee roughly per eye for you
per eye? Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And the $2,000 obviously is a huge difference, but to get two eyes done for it to be $800 in the difference, that's $1,600 in total.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
You wouldn't?
I would have spent the last 4 years just practically blind, because I couldn't even go for a cycle or drive the car. No way. I had to have it done.
And you're a cyclist, are you?
Yeah.
And what difference? That's presumably your exercise regime. How far would you go cycling? What difference does it make being able to cycle now?
Oh yeah, well I can go now and I can cycle 50, 60, 70 k's. No bother. I still need glasses. But, at the time, I couldn't even see a signpost.
So did you have to give it up altogether?
Yeah, I couldn't do any of that. I was lucky to just go for a walk.
And how long?
No driving.
How long were you off the road?
I was off driving for a full year. I didn't realise what was wrong for a while. I thought it was just, getting old, you see your side is starting to go, but it really rapidly got bad. And it was like that, go to Specsavers and they tell you, oh yeah, there's you got cataracts, So I had to go through the usual thing, letter from the doctor and a letter from the hospital then saying that I was on the waiting list for 4 years. And I was going to get it done down here. So I was absolutely delighted to find out that I could get it done somewhere.
And do you have to be on the waiting list for a certain amount of time before you can avail of this reimbursement? Is it, do you have to be on it for more than a year, or can you just go straight on this scheme and get it done?
I don't think you can go straight on it. I think you do have to have a letter from the department here that you would be waiting about 4 years, in my case. Now, whether that's enough, it was, but it might be less than that if you could prove that, but you do have to prove that you're on the waiting list and you will be waiting that length of time.
And €1,600 would have made a big difference to you. You doubt whether you could have gone ahead with it. Do you know if there was any other people, even from talking to them on the bus, who might have been in the same boat, or people maybe you've spoken to since?
I think at the time, everybody on the bus, they were all dependent on that. There's no way you could go private down here for anything. the idea of being reimbursed was fantastic. But I wouldn't have been able to do it.
No.
I had to get it done, really, if I wanted any quality of life.
Now, look, we have to say we are still waiting for a statement from the HSE in this. They did issue one to RTE, our colleagues in the newsroom earlier, and it said it has deferred reimbursement changes until tomorrow to ensure no one is disadvantaged. But the logic behind it is, they say that complex eye treatments, the cost of them, are due to fall from around 2,000 to 1,150, or the equivalent in Northern Ireland. But I suppose that's with the National Health Service equivalent. But what all of you are saying is that you've been dealing with private clinics So it's not clear whether there's an indication there that those private clinics will be cutting their costs. If the HSE, I suppose, have an indication to the contrary, we'd welcome that confirmation, maybe in a statement while we're still on air.
Yeah, I think they should definitely keep it. At the time that I had mind on, there was talk of just cancelling the whole thing. And I think it was Michael Collins got on about that and Danny Healy read it. They just, you know, whatever they said in the Dáil anyway, kept it going. But I think to more or less stop people having the operation done is a disgrace. It's more money they should be giving people to get it done,
sure,
not less.
Yeah, well, it's taken thousands of people off the waiting list since 2017, since this scheme was instituted. We're going to go to Claire. Claire Lawler, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
You've had one eye done in Belfast and another one in Derry.
That's right.
Any preference?
Well, the advantage of Belfast was that you could go out in the afternoon and see the city a bit.
Right.
But there wasn't time for that in Derry, really.
I'm sure the mood was good in Derry, though, seeing as you were completing it, you were getting the second operation done.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
it was great.
You've got it done. I suppose, as I've asked everybody else, when you took the patch off, what difference did it make on the second eye?
Yeah, well, it's amazing, like everybody has said. It's like you have glasses that are in your eye. You know, you see like I see through glasses. I still have to wear glasses, but it's that clear. It's incredibly clear. And I have to say that it feels to me like there's something different in the light, in the way I experience light, is all I can say.
So you have a medical card and you were put on the waiting list. How long were you on the waiting list, or how long were you given to understand you were going to be on the waiting list?
Well, I knew from other people that it was years. And because my husband has been through this process as well, and I had been up to Derry with him before to get his eye done, I just knew right away it was going to take time. So I said, don't even wait, just go, you know, just put your name down. I mean, I had to go on the waiting list, obviously, here in the Republic first. Yeah. So I don't know, it was about 6 or 7 months.
And how long ago did your husband get it done?
Oh, a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago.
And still worked as smooth. I mean, you'd been through it. You probably had the advantage on other people in that you'd sat beside him on the bus on the way up and you knew about
exactly.
The check-in with the consultants in advance and then being brought into the hospital the next day.
Exactly, yeah.
You weren't reluctant to take another. What is it? Is it about a 6 hour bus journey more? I think it is.
I was very reluctant. It just is a long way from West Cork. And I live in Ballydehob, so it was even further because you have to get to Cork, another hour and a half. It's a long way.
And what difference had it made to your life? I mean, how bad was your eyesight when you decided you were going to do this?
Well, I was like other people who said, I was finding it hard to read the signs on the road. I had to be right under them before I knew what they were saying. And so that was why I really felt like I've got to get it done, because I really need to drive.
So when it comes to putting the money together to get this done, how did you go about it?
Well, the same, I assume everybody else, I had to go to the credit union. The credit union was great in that they offer, you know, you have to pay it back, but they offer some kind of system that once you do pay it back, you're not paying for that money again. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's like as soon as they take it off, you're only paying what you have left to pay. You don't have to pay like the whole amount, and that made a big difference.
So you can pay it back basically whenever the reimbursement comes in, you can pay off whatever loan you've taken out with them. Would it have been difficult if you had to pay 800 more per eye?
Oh yeah, definitely. They're all absolutely. I mean, it feels like it's even a bit more. I know 800 is kind of like for the procedure, but then it was 120 for the bus on top. And anyway. Yes, definitely. The credit union was a lifesaver. It always is, actually. I find they're amazing. They're willing to give you loan you the money.
Pascal O'Connor, you've got them, I suppose, nearly a decade since you got both of them done.
8 years ago, Colin.
And you went the credit union route as well, did you?
I went the credit union. I was referred from my doctor to Knightsbridge in Belfast, and they got the HSE forms, the cross-border form, sent out to me, filled them out, went to the credit union, told the credit union I was looking for the loan, and they gave me the loan. And when it was reimbursed, I sent it back to the credit union.
And just straightforward. When you were putting together the loan application in the credit union, and you were writing down the go through the usual questionnaire, it was one of the things you put in on the application that you would be getting the reimbursement. Was that kind of an important part of securing the loan from the credit union in the first place?
Yeah. So, you had to get a letter from your doctor as well, and a letter from Knightsbridge, and send it in with the form.
And if you had to get, if you had been getting €800 less per eye on this, do you think you would have had a harder time getting the money?
I wouldn't have been able to afford it.
Now, as I say, the HSE, who there's a couple of issues we'd like to clarify with them, haven't sent us a statement on why they believe that the cost is going to come down in private hospitals. They're talking about the National Health Service equivalent operations going down, and that's why they're cutting the reimbursement. But if it had been cut in your time, do you think you would have gone ahead and got it done, or would it just have involved a bigger loan and more financial pain for you?
Well, I would have had to get it done, or I'd been totally blind. If that's been honest.
So you might have just had to take the hit.
Yeah, exactly.
And what kind of difficulty do you think that would have presented you with?
Oh, every kind of walk, driving, everything. I was involved in sports as well. That would have all stopped.
And you're talking to us from Dublin. So how did you hear about it? And who organised the transport for you?
I had the travel pass, so I made my own way up. But I had to have someone with me to travel with me and stay overnight and then travel back the next day.
Right, and who referred you to it? Did you have the help of a local politician, or was it...
No, it was me. It was my doctor, actually.
Was your doctor sorted you out with it? Right.
Yeah.
And did you stay up overnight, or did you didn't...
I stayed up overnight, yeah.
Right, and do you have any idea, going back 9 years, what the total cost of the two eyes and the accommodation and the whole bit off the top of your head?
The accommodation was $2,450.
Right.
In total.
And how much were you left paying then after the reimbursement?
Total, $250.
Right, okay.
With the reimbursement.
Okay, Val Casey, your brother and your friend also had this operation done.
Yes, my brother lives in the UK, and he had the operation done very, very quickly. I have another friend who's having it privately done, and he's been waiting for nearly a year. Now, Colm, I have to say, I'm absolutely shocked at hearing that they're talking about reducing the reimbursement. Because, first of all, people shouldn't have to go there in the first place. And because they do, all their costs should be covered. And then this coming back and telling us now that there's going to be a reduction, and so therefore they're going to reduce. They should wait until the reduction takes place. I mean, people who are suffering with cataracts are the elderly, and they're the people who need our help most. And they're not the people that you cut resources to when they have to leave the state to get operations they're entitled to. It absolutely really made me very, very angry to hear that today, because I do believe it's very important. We look after our older people. We're one of the wealthiest countries in the world. We should not be cutting the resources to help our old people so they can actually see. So that's basically my point, Colin.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the HSE says they're deferring changes until the 1st September, the day after tomorrow, and also that they say the most common cataract procedures will be reduced from about €1,400 to €1,100, and they'll communicate with patients. But I'm not sure whether they can guarantee a cost reduction, and whether or not that reimbursement will cover that. They might advise us of that if they can. All right, Paul, you needed both done.
I need both done now, Colm, yeah. I was attending the Ioneer. So just within a year, my eyes, cataracts had gone. Now, I was in with the Ioneer. I had about seven trips in. And the fourth week in July, I met with the surgeon. Can I say his name, the doctor?
Yeah, if you like.
Okay, his name is Dr. O'Rourke. He said, oh God, he said, I'll see you very shortly. He said, I'll see you around the fourth week in August, and we get one eye done, and then we do the second eye 2 or 3 weeks later. That's fine, no problem. Then I made all the arrangements for inpatients, and expect a phone call in about 2 weeks before your surgery. We go through a few things with you. So I got the phone call. I asked when am I coming in. He said, you want to speak to his secretary. So I rang the secretary, and she says, oh, yeah, he left 3 weeks ago.
All right.
He had left the hospital, so I'm left in limbo now. I have to go to Knightsbridge and pay for it myself. Now, I could have done this ages ago, but I didn't want to waste the hospital time by going and seeing them and then taking a trip up to Belfast.
All right. And tell us how you were referred to Belfast. How do you know that?
I expect Savers.
Right. So they referred you on to it through yeah. when you went to have your eye examination, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. He sent me, I'm about to go through 4 sets of lenses with glasses within a year. And he said, look, I think you're better going up to Belfast. He said, they're doing it quicker up there. I said, look, I'm going to wait because I've been through the system and I don't want to, waste their time after all the tests and all that. And now all of a sudden, I'm just left there, just thrown to the side. Only for I rang about my surgery. And she said, oh, the doctor had left the hospital three weeks prior.
Sure. And we have to assume that the doctor, in good faith, would assume that the system is going to keep working efficiently and you'd be seen without any interruption.
Yeah, but the phone call or letter saying, your doctor's gone.
I know, but I mean, the hospital's the hospital. The doctor himself works for a system. But going back to your system to your experience with Belfast, you're off, is it next week?
I head up next Friday evening at 7:10 for a consultation, yeah. And then I don't know after what's happening. I'll have to see how long it's going to take. The guy drives for a living. And I reckon, another month I'll be off the road.
Really? That bad?
That bad, yeah.
And how are you finding it on the road? What's, where are you seeing the worst degeneration in your eyesight?
It's the night time, maybe when the lights are shining too bright in your eyes, or, I have sunglasses. When the sun is too bright, then you have to put the sunglasses on and, I know you put sunglasses on when it's bright, but normally I don't wear sunglasses,
Right.
But I have to now because of the sun is so bright that it's stinging my eyes.
And have you any idea how much it's going to cost you?
Yeah, that's $2,100 per eye.
Per eye, so
sterling, yeah.
$4,200, and the reimbursement as it stands at the moment will give you $2,300, so you're €1,900 euro out of pocket yourself.
That's for the travel expenses and staying overnight, yeah.
All right. And do you mind me asking, how recently were you given that price?
I was given it, as soon as I heard about that the doctor had left the hospital, I made arrangements. I rang the lab inspector, who I know well due to going all the time to him, and he made arrangements. And I got a call from Knightsbridge, or Knightsbridge, yeah, or Kingsbridge, and they said, look, this is the situation. It's going to cost you $2,100 per eye, sterling, and we'll have you in on the 6th of September for the consultation. Now, a month later.
So when the HSE says that the cataract procedures are going to drop in cost down to about the equivalent of £766 sterling, or, in around, I suppose, €1,000, that's not the quote you've got. You've gotten twice that.
Twice that, yeah.
Right. Kingsbridge. But
that's I'm going to the one in Belfast. It's just on the Lisburn Road, the one I'm going to, yeah.
Okay.
It's handy for it. When you're staying in Belfast, you can get a taxi down rather than up the dirty way. You can get a bus or a train up there,
Have you already applied for the finance?
For the
loan, yeah.
Yeah, I got it. Fair play to credit union. When they heard it straight away, they gave me within 4 days, 5 days.
Right, but you told them you were going to be reimbursed. So as far as the credit union's concerned, you're getting €2,000, are you?
See, because I'm self-employed, I'm not sure what will happen because I'm over the threshold, but I could get it. Look, it's not about getting the money back. It's just, some of it is getting the money back.
Right.
But leave it to this late now to where I should have been done 2 weeks ago. Now I'm a month behind.
Okay.
Get the cataracts done,
All right, thanks, Paul. More on this with Eddie after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Or 0845 783333 from the north. You can get us by on WhatsApp 087 484 8888 for your text there, 51551 for your text. Eddie, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
How did you hear about the scheme in the north, the cross-border cataract scheme?
Actually, it was a program in RTE a couple of years back, but I just I went to an optician for the first time just to get my eyes tested because I knew my eyesight was a bit fading a bit for the first time. And again, just it was an optician here. And they said, oh, yeah, you've got a cataract in one of the eyes. And they said, well, you need to see maybe just to get it confirmed. You need to get it confirmed by somebody else, obviously, maybe some private ophthalmologist or whatever. And so that was it. But I was told that if you go down the public route, it would take 3 or 4 years, and then on the private, it would cost nearly 3,000, which I didn't. I didn't have any private health care. So I was thinking, Jesus, what will I do? And then it just happened. I was listening to a program on RT on the way home that evening, and it just mentioned it was about the whole cross-border initiative and getting cataract done and all that. So I actually just rang the hospital the following morning in Belfast, and I just said, how do I go about this? And they said, you just get onto the HSE and get the forms and what have you and go through go to the credit union, like some of your guests, and get a loan and what have you. And so I rang the HSE, and the thing is, and that's why when I hear programs or anybody mention cataracts, this is the kind of advice I give them, that they said the HSE, the person I was talking to, they said, all right, that's grand, it's all very fine. And then I just mentioned that the optician said I should go and see this private person to get this confirmed. And she said, if you had gone down that route, if I had gone to that private consultant, I wouldn't have been avail of the public service.
So, right. Had you gone to a private consultant in the south to get that confirmed, had you gone down that private route, you wouldn't have been eligible.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you have to go through the public system for this.
Yeah. So lucky enough, the person in the HSC, Fair Dewson, they just said, look, don't do it the private route, because if you go anywhere near a private, you won't be able to avail of the cross border initiative. As I said, when I rang the hospital, they were saying, well, we could see you next week or two, and that's what I did. I took the train up from Cork on a Wednesday morning, and I was seen to Thursday, and I was back in Cork that evening.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks for that word of warning from Cork, Eddie. Una Hart, good afternoon to you.
Hello, this is Una speaking. How are you?
Good, thanks. The words of the prophet Ezekiel.
Yeah, I was at a mass 2 weeks ago on Friday, August the 16th. And, you know, the particular mass I was at is kind of not relevant. But what was interesting was that there was a common reading there. And it's kind of read out at, you know, all the Catholic churches in the diocese. And it has nothing to do with the individual priest or church involved. But what really disturbed me was the imagery in this reading. So it's an Old Testament reading, chapter 16 from Ezekiel.
If anyone wants to get out their Good News or whatever edition Bible they have, it's Ezekiel 16:1.
That's right, chapter 16. And it was verses 2 to 15, 60 and 63. But what really, really bothered me was the imagery. So I was okay with, you know, the message. And every religion is entitled to its belief and its messages. But in this case, it was, you know, the imagery that was used. So it wanted to convey a message of being faithful, not to be self-focused or self-serving, not to lose the run of yourself, to keep your promises. But my goodness, how that message was conveyed. And the imagery was around females, baby girls and women in such an awful way, and it had no reference at all to men and what it could mean for them.
All right. Do you have the passage that you found offensive? Do you have it in front of you?
I do, and there's a few short bits of it. If you're okay for me,
if you're comfortable reading it yourself, read away.
So it starts, "Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations." And then later it goes on, referring to the birth of a girl. "As for your birth, the day you were born, your navel cord was not cut. you were neither washed with water nor anointed, nor you rubbed with salt nor swathed in swaddling clothes. No one looked upon you with pity or compassion to do any of these things for you. Rather, you were thrown out on the ground as something loathsome the day you were born. Now, that's an old that's part of it. And then it goes on later. Then I passed by and saw you weltering in your blood. I said to you, live in your blood and grow like a plant in the field. And this is the next bit that I found quite objectionable. You grew and developed. You came to the age of puberty. Your breasts were formed. Your hair had grown, but you were still stark naked. Again, I passed by you and saw that you were now old enough for love. So I spread the corner of my cloak over you to cover your nakedness. I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you. You became mine, says the Lord God. And then it says later, but you were captivated by your own beauty. You used your renown to make yourself a harlot, and you lavished your harlotry on every passerby whose own you became. And then some more. Then shall you remember your conduct and be ashamed when I take your six sisters, both older and younger than you, and give them to you as daughters, even though I am not bound by any covenant with you. And then just to finish it off, and that you may be remember and be covered with confusion, and that you may be utterly silenced for shame when I pardon you for all you have done, says the Lord God. And it just seems to me that the thought process about women is what's really disturbing, that they have no say. And that in this case, the church doesn't represent them, as it only speaks about men.
Right. And you were uncomfortable with this. I mean, were you shifting in your seat? Did you look around you? Did you check the reaction of any other women or indeed men in the church at the time?
I did, actually, because there were some people with me who weren't familiar with Catholic churches, one of the group who was with us. And he asked me about it and he was completely flabbergasted by it. He was trying to figure out, you know, where did that come from? What... was it the priest who selected it, or, you know, was he an extremist or something? No, not at all. And I suppose what I felt about it was that, you know, it made me upset in one way, disturbed and quite angry. And I thought about evolution, you know, everything else has evolved, whether it's the country of Ireland, our society, the world. And I don't really believe that the church can't also evolve to be inclusive of all of its members and to remove discrimination and exclusion. And this reading, it really enforced to me attitudes and behavior that are outmoded and outdated and relate to a time when life was very, very different, like more than 2,000 years ago.
Right. So, I mean, it may be reflective of its time. Women were, you know... very much second-class citizens at the time when the prophet Ezekiel was writing the words. And
I mean,
reading over it, I mean, did you look for an interpretation of this, what he was driving at? As you say, it opens with Son of Man, confront Jerusalem with her detestable practices, and it goes into the history of Jerusalem. It sounds like, I suppose, an admonition to the Jewish people of the time, saying that, you know, once upon a time, you know, they came from pagan stock, they... you know, they went into a covenant with a single God, and then maybe they strayed from that path afterwards, and a reminder to stay, I suppose, within the boundaries of the Ten Commandments. Is that what your reading of it is?
And that's, you know, I'd have no problem if it was that straightforward of a message.
It's the metaphor you object to, is it?
Oh, my goodness. You know, really, is there anywhere else in life now that we could be spoken to like that? And would I want a young girl to hear that sort of thing and to be influenced by it and to believe that that is appropriate, or to be treated and diminished in that manner by the imagery and metaphors that are used? I don't think so.
And as against that, somebody might argue, look, it's in the Bible. Are there certain passages from the Bible that should just not be, you know, not be read anymore in public, in a church context? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, I'm kind of saying that things have moved on. Do we really want to perpetuate this type of thing? And is it valid longer to portray things in this manner? Like, the message, as we've discussed, is fine, it's appropriate, and it's appropriate for a church that has strong beliefs in those values to do that. However, it's not appropriate to convey an image that says women are treated in this manner. It really isn't. And I don't think that we can be allowed to continue to do that. There is nowhere else in life that this type of language could be acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, the last verse of it that you cite there, 63, says, "And then when I make atonement for all you have done, you will remember and be ashamed and never again open your mouth because of your humiliation," declares the Sovereign Lord.
It's pretty heavy going, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, do you know if there is a range or a choice of readings any given Sunday that people can pick, and maybe this was option B and maybe option A should have been chosen, or is there only option A?
Well, to be honest, I'm not an expert in Catholic liturgy, but it seemed to me from what I looked up on the day, because I came home and I looked it up because I was just so bothered about it. And it does seem to be pretty standard. So they seem to rotate through different passages in the New Testament, the Old Testament, and for the Gospels. So this one comes up from time to time. But it did occur to me that as I read this, you know, this may be something that with our view now of the world and our greater understanding of the value of every human being, that maybe this is something that needs to go by the wayside.
Sure.
Like many other things, yeah.
I mean, generally, the first reading, the Catholic Mass up until the first reading is supposed to be reminiscent of the old Jewish rites. And then thereafter, it's supposed to be the newer Christian part. And the second reading comes from the New Testament. But the Old Testament is full of fire and brimstone and pretty heavy stuff and the destruction of cities and people being turned into pillars of salt and God calling on Abraham to sacrifice his eldest son. I mean, there's a lot in there. If you started to whittle down some of the heavier stuff, what would you be left with?
But, you know, is that the wrong thing to do, though? Is it the wrong thing to start critically looking at things and saying, what is it exactly that we want to tell people or to encourage people to do? Like, to me, religion has always been a means of helping me to live a better life, to make me reflect on the way I was living my life and what I could improve in it. But when you present what is the conveyed message or the purported message here, and you cloud it with that sort of imagery, it kind of mixes the message up, doesn't it?
Sure.
It doesn't make it...
Yeah, well, as you say, you make the point when language like that is being used, and it's a fairly archaic form of expressing that language as well. Do you think the message that may or may not be behind it shines through at all, or for a modern audience, are the phrases that you heard and particularly found offensive are going to be the ones that jump out at them?
I think so, absolutely. I think that the messages that convey women and that treat women in such a negative way, like, what does it do? The bottom line of the message is to live a better life. But if you cloud it in all of this stuff, message do young men get out of that? That women should be diminished? Really? Is that what it's intended to say? I don't think so, and I think we have to consider that carefully before we perpetuate something like that. I really do.
Was it a talking point after the Mass? You mentioned one of your friends spoke to you about it, but, you know, have you talked about it to people on any day since? Had anyone else heard it, or did it have the same effect on anyone else as it had on you?
To be honest, I haven't heard anybody else talk about it. It was a Friday, and so most of the people that I would have friends with would be working during the week. There aren't that many who'd be, you know, going to a Friday morning Mass and to hear it. But I'm actually very surprised that somebody else hasn't raised this with you. And I'd be very curious to hear how other people feel about it, because it's so extreme. And I'm not the sort of person who normally like rings Lifeline or does something like this. So I felt compelled in this case because it was so extreme. And truly because I felt that, you know, I have friends with young children or with grandchildren. And I'm kind of thinking, do those girls have to grow up listening to this stuff?
All right.
You know.
Well, as you know now, Rona, there is no one type of person who rings Lifeline. It is, if you'll pardon the pun, a broad church. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And if you're listening from the north or indeed from abroad, you can might want to write down this number 0845785333 because you might find what we're going to talk about now particularly relevant to you. Sarah Ironside, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. Good to speak to you.
Good to speak to you too. You're ringing us from Brussels. Why?
I contacted you just because to talk about the sort of not very level playing field for Irish students and not only Irish students who do their final school examinations in other than the Leaving Cert, who don't have the uplift and therefore access to university through the CAO it becomes very difficult because my child and other children go to European schools and do the European baccalaureate, which never had any uplift, even in 2020, when in fact the results went, were slightly lower, a small percentage lower than pre-COVID. And now, for the last 4 years, students find themselves achieving the highest possible marks, which gives them access to sort of prestigious universities in other countries in Europe or outside Europe, like the United Kingdom, like outside the European Union. And yet they have difficulty accessing the course that they would like to do in Ireland through the CAO.
Right. You might explain to listeners what the European baccalaureate is. Is it the same as the international baccalaureate or is it a different exam?
It's a different examination. The European schools were schools that were created in 1953 for the children of the staff of, at the time, the European Coal and Steel Community, the precursor of the current European Union. And at that time was in Luxembourg, and it was deemed necessary that to get staff to come and work in Luxembourg and ever since in all the other places where staff work for the EU, people are concerned that their children would have an education which would allow them access back into the education system of their home member state. So the European Baccalaureate is, well, it is it is run by an intergovernmental run. So the Irish minister has a seat on the board, and it should give a fair playing field for children to access on the same basis as any other citizen of their member state in this case.
But you make the point there. In the design of this exam, the key was that people would not lose the connection with their home education system. In other words, that they would at some point at least have the option of reverting into their home education system and maintain the link with the home country or that of their parents, at least the country of their citizenship. And it doesn't benefit from the grade inflation that's been afforded the Leaving Cert.
Yes, absolutely. And while some of us, like myself, are permanent civil servants of the European Union, there are people who come for 4 years on different kinds of, who are seconded by, we'll say, we're talking about the Irish here, who'd be seconded for 4 years. So it's extremely important that one can go straight back in. For example, Irish children in European schools have, from a very early age, the possibility to learn their own national language, Irish, which is a great sort of possibility for them. Both my children did Irish right up to their baccalaureate.
And can you sit an exam in the baccalaureate in Irish?
Yes. It's an exam subject.
Right. So you say you have two children there. Did one of them do the Leaving this year?
One did the, yeah, the European Baccalaureate this year, yes, Thomas.
Right, and how did he get on? Yeah.
He got on great, and he fortunately, he did get his choice of course in UL, where he will be studying science and exercise management. He's a rugby player, hoping to find an elite rugby player, so he's hoping to follow a career in rugby.
Right. His mommy, I'm sure, is hoping he applies himself equally, or at least partially, to the academics as well.
I like the rugby.
Right, okay.
The course is actually very much focused. It's one that is very focused towards, we'll say, athletes in all,
right,
obviously, in all disciplines who are looking towards careers in sport. But, you know, there is an academic side, which I have no doubt he will imply himself.
Right. Was he well prepared for it? Is the baccalaureate a hard exam?
It's a very hard exam. It's a very challenging curriculum. The difference with the Irish Leaving Cert is that it is based on continuous assessment, and there are final exams in June, written exams and oral exams, but the marks, you are gaining marks throughout the year for all your work throughout the year, and for an exam called the pre-bac, which takes place in the spring.
Right, when everybody here is doing what they call the mocks, and you had it, your daughter also did the baccalaureate. Did she fall foul of the system of grade inflation?
Yes, she did. She did. She's currently studying at Trinity, but the grade inflation then in 2022, she didn't get her first choice. She's very happy with her next choice, but she didn't get her first choice. And this is the case for, you know, many children. Again, this year, a number of children who have done extremely well would be considered, you know, in the very top percentage of the European Baccalaureate exams or other national exams.
Right.
There are Irish children that I know of in Belgium who got the highest level of distinction, and still doesn't give them access to the first choice of their courses.
All right. Well, because
it's really not possible in most other examinations to get the perfect score that one can get in the Leaving Cert of 100+%.
Okay, we're going to go to Kate, another caller. But just before I do that, Sarah, we've got statements in from the two relevant departments, just to run some of your concerns by them. The Department of Further Education says, Irish higher education institutions endeavour to ensure that access to the system is fair and equitable for all Irish EU, EFTA and UK applicants. They conduct regular statistical comparisons with official data provided by the relevant authorities in each country against Leaving Cert data. And it says it's developed new A-level to Leaving Cert equivalencies, which make it easier for students with A-levels to secure university places through the CAO. These new equivalencies are not coming into effect until next year. But on that issue of fairness and equity, that's not your experience in the case of your daughter, or indeed your son, who did happen to be lucky enough to get the course he wanted.
No, it's not. And if, you know, we have been, a number of parents have been lobbying both the Higher Education Institutes and Minister Foley. And a very simplistic, perhaps, approach would be that, and indeed there are equivalence tables which are very useful. And but if the equivalence table was, you know, if you have an equivalence that gives, you know, 550 points or 420 points, if the inflation upgrade like this year, which I understand is an average of 7.5%, was applied to that equivalence, that would level the playing field, in our view.
All right.
Sorry,
I beg your pardon. I want to just go to Kate Macklin, who's in the unusual situation of, Kate, your son did do the Leaving Cert, but he was living in Italy, but he had to do it under his own steam. Is that right?
Well, basically, yes, he did the Leaving Cert in Ireland, but he had been in, he was in school in Italy. So he finished his school in Italy and went over. He took off the last couple of months and he went over and he did the exams there. He did it in 2021. So it was the time when we were under serious lockdowns here. So after he did his orals in Ireland, he came back, but he had to go back to Ireland straight away, because otherwise he might have ended up in quarantine or he wouldn't have been able to get in. But I suppose my point is, when I heard the interview yesterday, I wrote just to say that if marks were given on the basis of the percentage you got, actually, and rather than a block of 15 points, that it might, or a 13 points, that, and every student got just exactly what they, the combination of their six subjects, that you would probably, it would be easier to put them into, that they would get the course they wanted. My son did very well, but he didn't get his first choice, although he had well over 600 points. He got a second choice, which was fine. But he, at the time, I suppose he was competing against people who were able to choose from predictive grades and maybe doing a couple of exams or not doing any exams and just having all predictive.
He didn't have that choice because he hadn't done classroom-based assessments in Ireland. He'd done his schooling in Italy and then did his final rush to the line. I wouldn't like to call it cramming because it sounds like he prepared heavily, but he did his basic, his exam preparation in the last few months while he was isolating in Ireland, effectively, on his own.
Yes, exactly. That was basically, he was on his own, yeah. We have five children, all of them have gone to university in Ireland, and the first two did their exams in Italy. But because of the nature of the, let's say, the equivalent of the Leaving Cert in Italy, it's not weighted in the same way for Irish universities. So we felt that he, that, you know, the best way for him to get the points he needed was to go and do the exam in Ireland. You know, we're very happy with the education system here, but the exam in Ireland is better for getting into university. And it was important for us that they did their university education in Ireland so that they would graduate through the English language.
Okay.
We
put in for a response from the Department of Education. Apologies for interrupting you there. They said they came back to us with a statement. They said the Minister of Education is very much aware that each year a proportion of the student population will be entering the higher education on the basis of qualifications from other jurisdictions. I appreciate, Kate, that doesn't apply in your case, but it says decisions on admissions, including the points awarded in respect of different qualifications, are made by the higher education institutions, who then instruct the CAO to make offers to successful candidates. So it's the third level colleges, says the Department of Education, that really make the call on this.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sure that's right. And I mean, I'm not complaining about this. My only point in my note today was that if they were given the actual points, you know, like 78 out of 100 or whatever number of points you got, then it would be easier possibly not to have 1,000 people on 625 when maybe they might be on 616 or 670.
Your percentage is your points, in effect, and it should just be stacked
exactly,
up rather than having bands.
Yeah, because, I mean, they have the marks. Obviously, they have the marks, so why not make it, do it like that? And then everybody is sure that what they get is what they deserve.
All right. Sarah, what...
And it's not pulled out of a hat.
Sarah, the statement from the Department of Education says as well that there'll be a phased return to normal results in 2025. So if they are drawing up a new table of equivalencies for 2025, they're indicating here that the bump up and grade inflation will be gone in that case anyway, and it'll be returned to the pre-COVID situation. But at the end of the statement, it says decisions on admissions, including the points awarded in respect of different qualifications, are made by the higher education institutions, who then instruct the CAO. So they're saying it's down to the institutions themselves.
Absolutely, but I don't dispute that at all. But it is the Department of Education that has decided to continue to uplift the Leaving Cert marks, and therefore the Higher Education Authority, or the higher education, they are then they give the table of equivalents, which is one thing, but you have the leaving cert, which then has a percentage uplift instructed by the Department of Education, whereas the people who sit exams outside the jurisdiction, they are left at the base rate, the base application. Whereas if there was no uplift at all, and I believe I have read somewhere, perhaps it is wrong, but I believe I have read somewhere that the minister has said that next year there will be they're anticipating a 5.5% uplift. I'm sure many of the parents,
right,
many of the students would be very glad if it is indeed that there will be no uplift and it will go back to the pre-COVID levels.
Right, yeah, as you said, it's a 7.5% bump up this year. If it's a 5% next year, that would be consistent with the statement saying there'll be a phased return starting next year. But just in terms of the query you raised with us, the statement of the Department of Education, it says it's the institutions that awards the points. Do you feel that goes any way to addressing the issue you raised with us?
No, I don't really, because the issue is more the uplift. And I think many of the institutions themselves, the higher education institutions, have expressed concerns publicly about the uplift. That, for example, if I understand correctly, so many, they've had to have a lottery system now for so many some of the very high the courses which require very high high points or the highest possible points, which leaves a situation where perhaps, because if you achieve the highest points, a student who achieves the 625, they cannot uplift it. That's as high as they go. Whereas a student who achieves 7.5% below that, I can't do the maths in my head, will be brought up to 625 and is then in the same lottery.
I think to do that calculation in our heads at this point would definitely require a H1 in Leaving Cert Maths or whatever the equivalent is in the European Baccalaureate. I'm going to bring in Victoria Bruce, because you're not in this situation yet, Victoria, but you are the parent of a child who will be doing the European Baccalaureate next year, and it's only the phased reduction of grade inflation only begins then, so it's likely it'll still be in place at a time when your child is making an application for Irish universities.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really worrying because, you know, we are at a situation where we're looking at the points and we've a child who's saying she'd like to do one course, and I'm having to say to her, you have no hope of getting those points. So that's very disappointing. You know, when I must say, when I heard about the inflation of the grades this year, which went from what we've heard from up to about 12% max, I felt like really disappointed. I felt really disappointed for my child who's been living here for 5 years, who lived in Ireland previously, all of whose friends in Ireland doing the Leaving Cert, you know, have a good, she has the same potential as them.
Right. And how important is it for her to attend an Irish university and re-establish those connections at, I suppose, a fairly pivotal phase in her life as she enters adulthood?
Absolutely. It's hugely important for her. You know, those are her roots. She's spent most of her life in Ireland. She wants to go back to Ireland. She went to the higher options last year. She spoke to all the different universities, and, you know, that's what she wants to do. But we have, you know, we've, as Sarah was saying, we've a double whammy. One, we've a conversion table, which is unfair to our students. And one thing I would say, like then we have this ongoing inflation, which still will affect our students. And our kids study to a very high level. Like some of the feedback we get is when the kids go to university, they do really well. They find the first course, the first year, quite easy because they're already at a very high level. And I would also point out, we must remember the hundreds of Irish students who are also studying in universities in Europe.
All right.
So it must be a two-way system, you know. If they, indeed, the Irish kids can go to Europe, I think there's 1,000 in the Netherlands, I heard.
Surely our
students from across Europe, the European schools should have a similar opportunities to study in Ireland.
Okay, Victoria, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We've got to go to a break. Maybe you talk to us this time next year and let us know how you got on and how that grade inflation affected your daughter. We're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.